Welcome to the Denver Medical Study Group Healthcare Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Hadley, CEO and founder of the Denver Medical Study Group. Our organization was founded in November 2008, and so this makes our 15th year that we've been in business. Now with over 1,350 members, primarily here in Colorado, but also in 28 other states. Our events include DMSG virtual lunchtime meetings, in-person evening events, and our DMSG healthcare podcast for your anytime listening pleasure. I'm excited to visit today with Dana Jacoby, CEO and founder of Vector Medical Group. Dana is a nationally recognized healthcare strategist who's been a keynote speaker at DMSG in-person meetings and webinars, as well as on our podcast. She's joining me today to bring us up to date on the activity and change in the healthcare space since our last podcast interview this past spring. Dana, thanks for joining me today. I believe our listeners know who you are, but would you share a little bit about your role as a healthcare strategist for physician groups and hospitals?
Absolutely, Chris. No, it is always an honor to be here with you. And as I say every time I'm on, I'm so grateful for the partnership with Denver Medical Study Group and all you do for healthcare. It's just so rare that you find places where you can have open conversations across all categories of healthcare. And I just always love that about Denver Medical Study Group. So, yeah, no, as you alluded to, I'm Dana Jacoby. I'm the founder and CEO of Vector Medical Group. And Vector was really started just because I realized that there was a major need for providers and hospital executives to have a safe place to come talk about their futures and the architecture of their futures as all of these themes were changing around the country. I had done medical market research all over the world prior to Vector and turned that medical market research brain on to really being able to dissect themes and trends that I felt like providers and CEOs needed to hear about so that they could, frankly, navigate their future successfully. And so that's how Vector was born. So it's great to talk to you. As always, a lot has changed since our last conversation. So I'm looking forward to diving in.
Sounds good. Well, I'll turn it over to you and let you bring us up to date since our interview with you in March.
Yeah, so just to bring your listeners back, Chris, back in March, you know, we were still very much seeing a ton of deal flow activity. It was interesting because a lot of deals from last year. So, you know, if you go back to March, but a lot of deals from December and the end of the year of 22 had pushed into quarter one of 23. So we were still seeing a lot of deal flow, but you could kind of see the market conditions starting to shift slightly. And what I mean by that was due diligence was going a little bit longer in deals. You know, we had certain buyers that would say, hey, I want to see how the market's going to perform in Q1 and Q2 of this year. You know, people were waiting to see if the Fed was going to raise interest rates again, which I think we now have seen a couple of those turns. So, you know, a lot of changes there. And then hospital CEOs, I feel like 2023 was the first time where they really feel like COVID is not behind them, but somewhat in the rearview mirror, in that they're kind of starting to look forward versus dealing with things like travel nurses and, you know, inflation costs, obviously, have always been a big deal, but became a bigger deal last year. And so it really was a very interesting quarter one, but we've seen a couple of shifts further, you know, the interest rates change again. Obviously, we talk about inflation, and you're starting to see a lot of additional themes hitting healthcare. I'll kind of give you some high points, but one, some of the big deals, so some of the large, you know, multi-$100 million deals are going a lot slower than they were in 2022 and 21. They're going longer, but buyers are being more finicky or investors are being more finicky in what they're looking at. Due diligence, as I mentioned, is starting to go even longer, or people are saying, hey, we'd like to hold off this year until we see what's going to happen in Q3 and Q4. Smaller deals, on the other hand, in healthcare are still very much hot. I mean, I would have thought that our business at Vector would have slowed down substantially by now, and we've honestly never been busier, but it's more of the middle market and lower middle market physician groups that are bolting on to the larger deals that have been done. And also, if you're a smaller doctor group, you're feeling the pressure. You're feeling the pressure of inflation. You're feeling the pressure of reimbursement cuts. The other probably biggest theme this year that I think I had mentioned to you previously, Chris, but your listeners haven't heard it yet, is that we're getting calls a lot more from hospital specialists. So hospital doctors who are starting to say, you know, I've heard about these investors outside of my group, you know, whether it's private equity or some of these other themes coming into healthcare, I'd like to look at my options outside of the hospital. And I may not jump, but I'd like to at least be knowledgeable about that. And if you would have interviewed me last year at this time, that was probably 5% of the calls I was getting. It's now upwards of 20% of physicians and specialists that are thinking, they're watching their peers, you know, go sell to private equity or sell to a strategic. They're seeing ambulatory surgery centers standing up around them, and they're starting to weigh their options of what it might look like outside of the hospital walls. And so our hospital CEOs are starting to see that theme and, you know, a lot of possibilities where they may co-invest with doctors who are leaving, or they may be willing to let the doctors leave in order to co-invest. So it's interesting. It's kind of a confused market in that, while at the same time we're watching a little bit of slowdown, there's a lot of capital still sitting on the sidelines that has to be deployed. So it's, you know, definitely still very busy. It's just a different kind of busy than we saw in quarter one of 2023.
Dana, one of the things you talked about, inflation and those factors, has the work shortage been a problem in recovery, as well as the supply chain issues?
You know, so again, and it's funny, Chris, in March, I mean, I would have said, yes, we were still digging out of a nursing shortage. Supply chain definitely has been something that has been a struggle. You know, I won't say it's completely caught up, but I think due to the fact that there's inflationary pressures and hospitals, like I said, mainly hospitals, but also doctor's offices have gotten their sea legs again, we're watching some of those shortages really go away. If you read some of the healthcare news, a lot of the nursing shortages, all of a sudden travel nurses aren't being hired back again. Like, travel nursing contracts aren't needed anymore. Nurses are going back to work. You know, some of our nurses were just frankly burnt out from COVID, and I don't blame them. You know, wearing an N95 on the floor every day when you're dealing with a shortage of nursing. I mean, some of our nurses really had a hard time. I was with a hospital CEO a week ago, and they said, and this is going to blow your mind, but 40% of their nurses in their hospital were fairly new. In other words, so what we've seen is a lot of newer nurses coming into the midst, where a lot of the retired nurses that were more mature have retired, but it's catching up. I mean, you're starting to see reprieve on supply chain. You're starting to see reprieve on the shortages. You know, people are going back to work again for a lot of reasons. People are going back into the offices. People are going back into the hospitals versus if you think about where we were in 20 and even early 2021, a lot of our hospitals couldn't find enough nurses just to man the beds on the floor. So they were hiring outside. They were hiring out. And then obviously we all know what happened with the masks and shortages of, you know, PPE. I mean, that was a national and international trend, and that's definitely caught up. There's, you know, a plethora of that stuff sitting now, which we didn't have that luxury last year.
You know, one of the things that we hear about is the success of the ambulatory surgery centers and the interest in ownership of those surgery centers, both by hospitals and by private equity investors. Is that really developing more by private equity investors? Are they looking at acquiring ASCs?
Absolutely, Chris. Acquiring and building. That's one of the biggest themes of the last 36 months. And you could see it coming even pre-COVID. But when our hospitals, you know, had a shortage of specialists and also shut down a lot of their elective cases, our doctors that had ambulatory surgery centers were able to keep their facilities open and thriving. The other thing, if you, and I don't know if you know, you've had the chance to read it yet, it literally just came out a couple of days ago, but if you look at the new reimbursement trends for 2024, usually Center for Medicare and Medicaid launches the reimbursement cuts or reimbursement ranges around this time. It usually comes out around August, and then there's a lot of debate before it's actually finalized in the back half of the year. But when you see the cuts towards orthopedic surgeons or, you know, cardiovascular in office versus what they could make in an ambulatory surgery center, it's very clear that even Center for, you know, CMS is pushing patients out into outpatient facilities. I mean, you can literally see in hospital or in office going down. I'm being somewhat broad brush, but, and ASC is going up. So the private equity firms definitely see the ambulatory surgery centers as one of their biggest opportunities for investment. The other thing that we're watching nationally with ASCs in some of our more sophisticated geographies and groups is physician groups and even hospitals are starting to talk about going direct to employer for ambulatory surgery center build. So in other words, if let's say we're in Atlanta and Coca-Cola is our largest employer in the geography, instead of going to Blue Cross Blue Shield or Humana, we may go to Coca-Cola and say, we have the surgery center, we'd love to do an at-risk contract directly with you, Coca-Cola, or directly with you, Walmart, or directly with you, largest transportation, you know, group in Detroit. And we're watching a lot of those themes. If you own your own ambulatory surgery center, you can control the cost, you can control the quality. And so that is definitely one of the hottest sectors when it comes to private equity investment. And to your point, Chris, hospital investment, because hospitals are also realizing they can do a lot of their procedures outpatient and for the same exact themes that we just talked about. So when a private equity firm invests in a physician group, one of the biggest questions they have is, can they build ambulatory surgery centers? Do the doctors have any non-competes where they couldn't overcome that? And then also, you know, what's their geographic catchment area for that ASC in order to grow that business? It's a very, very hot space.
You know, as I listen to you sharing that, it's really significant. What the hospitals are going to have to do as they go forward, because basically they're losing patients on an inpatient basis there. And so what else can they do besides the ASCs? Is there any reason for them to merge with private equity investments, or is there anything going on there that you want to talk about at this time?
Yeah, you're very astute, Chris. I'll answer your latter part of the question first before the former, but we do have some hospitals recently that are saying, you know, if you can't beat them, join them. And they're basically saying, why wouldn't we co-invest or joint venture with a private equity or a physician group? We have one situation right now where it's a private equity, a hospital system, and a physician group all co-investing. We have another situation right now, believe it or not, where it's, you know, kind of, it's, you know, Amazon, Optum, Walgreens, Walmart, and CVS are becoming some of our biggest Medicare Advantage holders nationally. We have some of those folks co-investing with health systems right now. So I think that if I were a hospital CEO, or if I were looking down the pike at being in the hospital sector, you have a lot of opportunities. You know, there's hospital at home things that are launching where the patient may not come into your facility, but you're able to deploy telehealth or manage them through wearable devices outside of the actual hospital walls. To your point, you could co-invest or joint venture with some of these other entities. It shouldn't be an us versus them. It should be what for my region or for my geography, what's the best overall opportunity for us to grow the business and frankly to create really, really good patient care. And it's going to look different depending on where you fit and what you do. And then last but not least, I just think it's a different generation of patients. They're able to get information online. They're able to get information through their wearables. You know, a lot of them are wearing eye watches or Fitbits, or, you know, their iPhone is tracking their data. So, you know, you now have a more sophisticated patient base that you're going to have to figure out technologically as a hospital CEO how to touch and serve them. And so a lot of our hospitals are really disrupting from inside out what that is over, what that's going to look like long term. Still a lot of TBD. I mean, there's pilots going on nationally, but one of the more interesting hospital engagements we were on, they actually had set up a control tower over kind of all of these themes. And it was almost like an FAA tower over the wearables and the, you know, ASCs and everything else. And it wasn't like everything had to come inside of the walls in order for them to outreach. And I think that's very intuitive for the way patient care is going to be handled long-term.
You know, one thing that I haven't heard you address yet is the emphasis on behavioral health and the dynamics going mm-hmm. on there. Do you see that becoming a bigger tool for private equity or hospitals or both?
Yeah, you know, Chris, that for private equity and for, hospitals, yes, but mainly primary care roll-ups, mental and behavioral health. I don't know that folks were as educated as they are now about what that actually meant. COVID really brought to the forefront a lot of the need to serve and address that alongside of patient care. So we have watched, I mean, that's been one of the hottest investments over the last 24 months is mental and behavioral health methodologies. You know, as far as in a hospital or in a large health system, what that actually means to them, I think they're trying to figure it out. You know, I think there was a lot of confusion about what that actually, what that sector actually was, because there's so much to it, right? There's therapy, there's family dynamics to it. There's a lot of different things. There's drugs. There's a lot of things in the mental and behavioral health space, but I think we're definitely getting there. As far as private equity was concerned, that was one of the hot, anytime an asset would come online that was in that bucket, it had, a lot of different investors that were more than eager to take it off of their hands. And a lot of those deals got into bidding wars in order to figure out how to basically get them to the right buyer. So we'll see. I mean, I think it's definitely here to stay. COVID brought it to the forefront that it was an important part, or a more important part, I should say, of patient care. I think it also, similar to the conversation we just had, it also allowed the patient to be able to bring those themes into the office. You know, it's not the stigma that it was before, similar to the wearables, where all of a sudden the patient is a very astute, educated patient on mental and behavioral health. We just didn't have those conversations as much pre-COVID.
You know, we just did a podcast interview with Natalie Lamberton, the CEO of Denver Springs Behavioral Health Inpatient Hospital. Yeah. And she said the attitude toward mental health is changing. People are not, you say, are not afraid to step out and say, hey, I need some help.
Right. No, absolutely. I think it, you know, I don't know if maybe stigma is too strong a word, but I think COVID really brought to the forefront a lot of those challenges and how important they were, not just to, you know, patient care overall, but also just patient outcomes. I mean, that's a big part. I remember pre-COVID, we didn't have a lot of those questions on primary care checklists when a patient would come into a primary care office. And now it's almost an industry standard, which is just interesting to me. It should have probably always been there. We just didn't have it as one of the metrics we were looking at. So it's just fascinating to see how quickly some of these shifts have changed. And honestly, Chris, COVID took some of these strategies that we had 10 years or a decade out, brought them to a 24-month change. So we're still working our way through a lot of those themes, which is just fascinating to me.
I agree. You mentioned something a little while ago about 40% of the nursing staff is now fairly new, in both in age and experience in healthcare. There was recently an article I saw on Modern Healthcare where nurses under the age of 25 have a lot of options in what they can do and how much they can get paid, but there's a significant amount of burnout there because they're not emotionally or psychologically or trained to handle the opportunities they're getting. Do you see that
as a
factor?
I do. I mean, I think that especially the nurses that are new, I mean, think about it. Like, think about if you were in nursing school in, I'm just going to arbitrate. Let's say you were in nursing school in February of 2020. I mean, one, your nursing school was not a normal nursing school because some of it wasn't even in person, right? Because it couldn't be. Yeah. Two, you didn't get the touch to the patient that you know, could have or should have had. Three, a lot of your more mature nurses were either retiring in droves or weren't showing up as much to work because, I mean, they had earned their right not to have to do that. And you got thrown on the floor, literally, you know, on the job training in 21, 22 without having the same depth of med school or nursing school training that maybe your predecessors did. I think some of that, Chris, is going to even out over time. I think, you know, some of it is just the stress of the overall cadence of healthcare and all the chaos and change that we've gone through over the last 24, 36 months. And then some of it, you know, healthcare to me is a lot harder than it used to be back in the day when we just did rounds on the patients. Now there's technological concerns, there's charting that is much more in depth than it was back in the day. So I think some of these nurses are going to have to figure out where the right place is for them to practice, you know, but to your point, they have a slew of options. I mean, you have the Amazons and CVSs and Walgreens coming into the world. You've got hospitals, you've got hospital at home scenarios, you've got private practice. I mean, so all of a sudden, sky's the limit. You used to have a hospital or an independent medical practice, and that was kind of it. Now you can, I have a young lady who literally went and she was a nurse on the floor in the hospital. Then she became a travel nurse. And now she started her own online training course to train other nurses. Those are three in the course of a 5-year period. She's had four careers. I mean, it's fascinating. So I think sky's the limit for some of these younger nurses if they take advantage of the disruption of healthcare.
Yeah, Dana, I really appreciate your time today. We've covered quite a bit, and I appreciate the opportunity for an update on the dynamics of change that are going on in private equity. I look forward to our next podcast interview with you, where you're going to talk about the evolving marketplace. And I know you'll have a lot to share with our listeners because it includes areas we haven't even addressed yet today. And it's so dynamic, which is exciting. So thank you so much for joining me today. It's always a pleasure to get an update from you, and we'll see you again soon.
Sounds great, Chris. Thanks. It's an honor to be with you. I really appreciate the time.